Hello, you're listening to Science Digest. I'm Lynn Spears, a volunteer reading for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'm going to be reading several articles from Scientific American, Winter-Spring 2026 edition. One of the articles I'll be reading is called How to Boost Your Immunity, Some Simple Practical Steps That Can Raise Your Resistance to Viruses by Claudia Wallace. Fear and fraud often travel together. As coronavirus anxiety began to spread across the land, so did bogus nostrums, promising protection from the modern-day plague. As early as March 6, 2020, U.S. regulators began to issue warnings to companies that were promoting false claims, such as this one touting the benefits of drinking a daily dose of silver particles. It's actually widely acknowledged in both science and the medical industry that ionic silver kills coronaviruses. No. For people who hope to build up their resistance to coronavirus and infections of all kinds, there are no magic formulas. But there are some science-based steps that one can take to maintain a healthy immune system. For starters, don't smoke. Cigarette smokers are much more vulnerable to respiratory infections. Second, make sure you are covering all your nutritional bases with a wide variety of vegetables, fruits, and other elements of a healthy diet. Eating an optimal diet reduces the risk of getting an infection and reduces the severity of infections, says Wafali Faswa, professor of nutrition, epidemiology, and global health at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Third, practice good sleep hygiene so you can raise your chances of an adequate nightly rest. And fourth, get regular exercise, which will also help you sleep. On the dietary front, several nutrients have been tied to improve resistance to viruses. Taking zinc supplements, for example, has been linked to a reduced rate of respiratory infections and shorter duration of related symptoms. Deficiency in zinc, a mineral found in meat, shellfish, nuts, and whole grains, is more prevalent in less developed countries, Faswi notes, but it can occur in wealthier nations, especially during a time of high unemployment and disruptions to the food supply chain. Vitamin C and D have also been shown to improve resistance to respiratory infections. Perhaps relevant to COVID, vitamin C plays a role in reducing tissue damage from our own immune responses. Oral doses of the vitamin have also been shown to shorten the amount of time in an ICU and on a ventilator for heart surgery patients, according to a 2019 meta-analysis. Could it help COVID patients? Researchers are looking into it, Fazi said. As for vitamin D, a 2017 meta-analysis of 25 randomized controlled trials found that vitamin D supplements cut the risk of acute respiratory infections, especially for people with low levels of the vitamin. Rates of deficiency in the U.S. are higher among Blacks and Hispanic people. Fazi points out that late winter, early spring, when the pandemic began in the U.S., happens to be when vitamin D levels are especially low, because we acquire the nutrient mainly via sun exposure. Fazi and his colleagues investigated whether vitamin D might help COVID patients, but their results suggested that it didn't improve outcomes. He does suggest taking a basic multivitamin. A supplement with the recommended daily allowances of vitamins and minerals would be prudent, he says, along with a balanced diet. It might particularly help elderly adults who are prone to nutritional deficiencies. As for sleep, scientists have long known that it plays an essential role in bolstering our defenses. Studies have shown if you deprive people of sleep after administering a vaccine, they will produce a weaker antibody response than folks who have slept. Research suggests that sleep enhances the migration of T cells to the lymph nodes, where they are presented with foreign molecules that trigger antibody protection, explains neuroscientist Lucia Besendowski, who investigates sleep and the immune systems at Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich in Germany. A 2015 study that measured average sleep duration for 164 healthy volunteers and then dripped rhinovirus into their nose found that those who slept 6 or fewer hours a night were 4 times as likely to develop a cold as those who slept more than 7 hours. Similarly, a study that followed 57,000 women found that those who slept 5 or fewer hours nightly were 40% more likely to have developed pneumonia over a 4-year study period than 8-hour sleepers. Prolonged sleep loss, Beskodowski says, can create a state of low-grade inflammation. This seems to exhaust your immune system in the long run, so it may not be able to fight infections that well. Committing to a regular bedtime and nightly routine that help you sleep, along with a healthy diet and perhaps a multivitamin, will not necessarily necessarily keep the coronavirus at bay, but these steps have a true silver lining of helping you endure whatever health threats blow your way. Our next article is called Cold Remedies That Really Work. Snotty, stuffy noses are the hallmark of cold and flu season, but some medications and at-home remedies may offer relief, by Marla Broadfoot. Respiratory illness season is here, and with it typically comes snotty, stuffy noses. In the fall of 2023, a U.S. Food and Drug Administration panel concluded that oral phenylephrine, a common active ingredient in cold and allergy medicines, is useless at clearing up congestion. Now that many over-the-counter drugs officially don't work, what are some other remedies and medications children and adults can turn to? It's always been a hot topic, says Andrew Lane, a rhinologist and director of Johns Hopkins Sinus Center. Whether it's the cold and flu season or allergy season, seems like year-round congestion is one of the most common things people come in to see us for. Lane treats nose and sinus problems and studies how the specialized cells lining the nasal cavity and sinuses participate in the body's immune response and can contribute to chronic inflammation. He talked with Scientific American about what causes nasal congestion, as well as what treatments work and why. What follows is an edited transcript of the interview. What is nasal congestion? What exactly is happening inside our nose when you feel stuffed up? Basically, congestion is the swelling of the mucous membranes that line the nose. These mucous membranes help to warm and humidify the air we inhale. The nose is constantly sensing the environment and changing how much air is let through and how much moisture should be added. It does that primarily by dilating or expanding the blood vessels underneath the mucous membranes, which makes the tissue swell. There's also swelling that occurs from inflammation, such as the immune system's response to triggers in the environment. For example, when you have an infection, your body needs to bring inflammatory cells to that tissue to fight it off. The blood vessels swell and become kind of leaky, leading to fluid buildup in the tissue. You might also notice that your nose looks red when you are congested. The redness comes in part from those swollen and inflamed blood vessels. So, nasal congestion is not caused by the buildup of mucus, but is more about swelling and inflammation? They do go a little bit hand in hand because mucus helps to moisten the air before it reaches the lungs, and you typically have more mucus production when there's inflammation. But I think of the congestion being more from the stuffiness caused by the swelling of the mucous membranes than from the mucus itself. Well, what triggers nasal congestion? The most common cause of nasal congestion are allergies and viral infections, such as those that cause cold or flu. There's also a form of congestion that has to do with position, where people might complain of being stuffy in one nostril after lying on their side. And then there's congestion that comes from irritants in the environment, such as perfume or smoke. Well, what oral decongestant medications work, and how about nasal sprays? Pseudoepinephrine is an excellent decongestant that has been around for a long time. It works by constricting the blood vessels, so it counteracts the stuffiness caused by the dilation of vessels that I talked about earlier. Because pseudoepinephrine is chemically related to the stimulant amphetamine, people started making crystal meth out of it, and it was taken off the shelves and put behind the pharmacy counter. That made the medication harder to access, so some people turned to another decongestant, phenylephrine. Unlike pseudoepinephrine, which can raise blood pressure and make people feel a little hyped up, phenylephrine has fewer side effects, which makes sense because it basically has no effects at all, as the FDA panel concluded. The panel's decision hasn't changed how we treat nasal congestion because those of us who prescribe these medications know oral phenylephrine never really worked. Phenylephrine does work when it is delivered directly to the nose as a spray, however, as does another decongestant called oxymethazolone. The latter is very strong and fast-acting. You should use these sprays only for 3 days, though. Any longer and you risk making things worse. These medications act on adrenergic receptors on the blood vessels that line the nose's mucous membranes. If you take the spray around the clock for many days in a row, those receptors get overstimulated and become resistant to the medication. The effects last less and less, and people keep using it more and more frequently until they feel like they can't breathe without it. We call that retinitis medicamentosis, or rebound congestion. Well, what about nasal steroid sprays? That's the long game. If you have allergies, then nasal steroid sprays such as fluticasone can help if you use them consistently over a longer period. Steroid sprays work to reduce inflammation, so they're not working directly on blood vessel constriction. In that same vein, if your congestion is caused by an allergy, there are other options such as antihistamine pills and sprays that aren't necessarily going to work if your symptoms are instead caused by a cold. Well, are there any other types of remedies that are effective such as saline solutions, hot showers, chest rubs, or even a comforting bowl of chicken noodle soup? Saline rinses, which involve moving salt water through your nasal passages, can be helpful because they hydrate the nose and eliminate irritants that might be driving inflammation. There are good data to show that symptoms are improved with nasal saline. You can deliver saline with a nasal spray, squeeze bottle, or a neti pot. Another popular remedy involves steam. I was taught that steam is perfect for your nose because it's already warm and moist, so your nose can relax. But I've also seen studies showing that cool air helps open the nose. There seems to be mixed data, and it depends on the circumstances. Temperature and ambient humidity seem to impact how congested some people are, or at least how congested they feel. A hot shower or a bowl of hot soup can create steam, and I think that would act like a decongestant. Menthol, an ingredient in Vicks Vapor Rub, Tiger Balm, and other chest rubs, is an interesting one. It does absolutely nothing to any of the objective measures of nasal airflow, but it does improve subjective ones. That's because the nose has temperature-sensitive sensors inside that can detect air movement. Menthol tricks the nose into thinking there's a lot of airflow because it creates a cooling sensation even when there's absolutely no difference in airflow. A bunch of aromatic compounds, such as eucalyptus and spearmint, have a similar effect. Another factor that can affect nasal congestion is posture. Your nose will be more congested when you lie down because blood pools in those vessels in the nasal structures and the mucosae, or mucous membranes. If you sleep with your head elevated on a pillow, you'll probably have less congestion. It's just gravity, right? If you twisted your ankle, you would want to prop it up to decrease swelling. Keeping your head up above the level of your heart is going to make your nose less inflamed and less swollen. Well, do you have any parting advice for people suffering from nasal congestion? Yes, you're just trying to relieve your symptoms while you wait for the congestion to run its course. Stick with things that are less likely to cause side effects, such as saline or chicken soup. There are over-the-counter medications that are effective and generally safe, but some people do experience side effects. If you take a medication once and it makes you feel sleepy or jittery, just don't do it again. Nasal congestion only gets concerning if it becomes a persistent problem. In that case, you want to rule out other causes such as nasal polyps or tumors, and you might need a surgical procedure to open the nasal passages. Not everything is just allergies or cold, so if it doesn't really fit that picture, see a doctor. Our next article is called Allergic to Your Pet? Developing an allergy to your dog or cat can be a nightmare, but hyposensitization could offer permanent relief, by Christian Gillette. It's a nightmare for any dog or cat owner suddenly developing an allergy to their pet. Belly rubs and cuddles bring red eyes and a runny nose. Some people can no longer even be in the same room as a pet without their respiratory system sounding the alarm. Medical professionals' advice in such cases is unanimous. It's best to find the animal a new home because the odds of an allergy disappearing are extremely low. In fact, living with the animal increases the risk that allergic rhinitis, commonly known as hay fever, will turn into more serious allergic asthma. But saying goodbye to an animal friend is an unbearable thought for many allergy sufferers. And for some, it's not just an emotional problem, but also an existential one. This is the case for people who need a guide dog, for example, or who have a job in which they can't avoid contact with animals. An allergy sufferer's immune system acts like an overzealous security guard that keeps mistaking harmless visitors for dangerous intruders. If an innocent visitor fits a certain pattern, the guard automatically detains them and sends messengers to alert the entire security apparatus of the apparent threat. In this analogy, the classic allergy drugs, antihistamines, take over various security posts where they can prevent the messenger substances, histamines, from raising alarm. But this only temporarily relieves symptoms. The security guard still thinks the harmless visitors are dangerous. For more than 100 years, however, there has been a procedure that can address an allergy's root cause, specific immunotherapy, also called hyposensitization. As early as 1911, pathologist Leonard Noon used it to successfully relieve hay fever. To this day, it remains the only known treatment that can permanently re-educate the immune system. Hyposensitization works like this. An allergy sufferer's body is exposed to very small and then gradually larger amounts of the harmless visitors or allergens, and the immune system learns over time that they are not really dangerous, but if too much is introduced at once, the guard panics, and the immune system learns slowly. Retraining it takes at least 3 years. In this process, there are two ways to introduce allergens into the body in a controlled manner. Injections under the skin, called subcutaneous immunotherapy, and drops or tablets dissolved under the tongue, sublingual immunotherapy. The injections or allergy shots require visiting a doctor, say, weekly at the beginning of the treatment, and later, say, about every 4 weeks. The tablets or drops are taken under medical supervision the first time, and then daily at home. You are listening to Science Digest. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. Allergy shots for animal dander are available in the U.S. Allergy tablets are approved by the Food and Drug Administration only for ragweed, grass pollen, and dust mites. Drops are not approved by the FDA. Europe has approved more subcutaneous and sublingual treatments, including injections, drops, and tablets. Specific immunotherapy has proved effective for tree and grass pollen, and experts assume in principle that it can also work for allergies to animals. The effect of both methods is about the same for cats as well as dogs. In 70 to 80% of people who finish the therapy correctly, complete success occurs in the sense that they hardly notice any symptoms, says Carl Christian Bergman, an allergist at the Institute of Allergology at a university medical center in Berlin. The first improvements are usually seen after 3 or 4 months. Bergman says, and then they can take a cat on their lap, and it's very likely they won't have a cold or watery eyes anymore. Once a 3-year treatment is completed, the effect usually lasts for several years, but that doesn't mean the allergy is cured forever. It's possible that symptoms will come back after a few years, Bergman says. No one can say how likely that is. The best argument for hyposensitization is that it reduces the risk of potentially dangerous spread of allergy symptoms from the upper to the lower respiratory tract, from allergic rhinitis to allergic bronchial asthma, for example. The first signs that such a change have occurred are often chest discomfort and an irritating cough. In severe asthma, the bronchi become chronically inflamed and constricted. There is a risk of shortness of breath or even life-threatening respiratory distress. In principle, this spread of allergies can be prevented by specific immunotherapy, but the study record for animal allergies, unlike for plant pollen allergies, is modest. Records of success come only from very small studies, and the covered time periods are short. For dog allergy sufferers, there are no large studies at all. The 2022 German Guidelines on Specific Immunotherapy mentions limited evidence for efficacy in allergies to cats and insufficient evidence in dogs. They therefore call for critically weighing the benefits and risks. This is because there is evidence that serious side effects occur more frequently with treatment involving animal allergens than with other types, warns Medical Research Center Helmholtz Munich's Allergy Information Service. One example is severe anaphylactic shock, a life-threatening bodily shutdown. The first signs can be harmless, similar to mild side effects that usually pass quickly. After a shot, the skin around the injection site reddens, and after the patient takes drops by mouth, the oral mucus itches. But if the larynx swells up or the circulatory system collapses, the situation quickly becomes dangerous. There's a risk of respiratory distress, unconsciousness, and organ failure, an emergency that must be treated immediately. This risk is the main reason that immunotherapy is often not recommended for pet allergies, says Margita Wurm, an allergist also at the same institute. Compared with immunotherapy against pollen, intolerance reactions occur disproportionately often, she says, adding that deaths are extremely rare and that the danger of a reaction, such as anaphylactic shock, is probably highest for those who already suffer from asthma or other risk factors. Still, Wurm says, you simply can't rule it out in anyone. And treatment is especially difficult if patients continue to live with their pets because their exposure to allergens is not controllable. Adam Chaker, an ear, nose, and throat specialist at a Technical University of Munich's hospital, agrees, but he draws a different conclusion. The risk of a life-threatening allergic shock from immunotherapy for a pet allergy is 1 in 1,000,000. Checker says it is conceivable but highly improbable that a person could die in such a case if one can exclude risk factors such as cardiovascular diseases. He says specific immunotherapy is extremely safe if contact with the animal and its allergens can be minimized. The allergy must be under control. Checker is confident that hyposensitization works when it is used correctly. he and his team have investigated the molecular mechanisms behind allergies with a focus on various biomarkers that indicate at the outset whether a specific immunotherapy will be successful after 3 years. There is no evidence that treatment is less effective for one respiratory allergen than for another, he says. The therapy can be more difficult, however, if it requires several different allergens from one species. That's because the extracts used come from the animals themselves, and their compositions can vary. Cat allergy sufferers, the issue is usually negligible because more than 90% of them react to the main cat allergen. But for people with dog allergies, the problems tend to be spread across different allergens. Hyposensitization, as well as diagnosis of dog allergies, is therefore more often complicated. There's also less demand for immunotherapies against dog allergies compared with those for cat allergies. Allergies to dogs usually don't cause symptoms as severe as those to cats, Worm explains. Those affected are more likely to opt for systematic therapy with antihistamines and to banish the dog from the bedroom. She advises against permanent treatment of the symptoms with cortisone because of the side effects. Allergy sufferers who continue to live with their dog, however, do have a higher risk of developing asthma, albeit lower than they would with a cat. The therapy of choice, therefore, is always to find the animal a new home, Worm says. Chakra agrees and says it would be even better not to get into this situation in the first place. He adds that people often tell him, "I want a dog, but I already have other allergies. Is that possible? My child has neurodermatitis. Can we still get a cat?" In such cases, Chakra says, his answer is that it's not a good idea. Anyone who is already allergic is in a high-risk group for further allergies and allergic asthma. The situation is different when contact with the animal is difficult to avoid, as with visually impaired people who need guide dogs. In such cases, Chaka recommends specific immunotherapy with the necessary precautions. At the beginning of the treatment, the symptoms must be reduced as much as possible, especially in the case of asthma. This is particularly crucial in the first weeks of therapy, when as few allergens as possible should be allowed in from the outside. In the case of pollen allergy, the treatment should initially start in a pollen-free season. This reduces the risks and increases the chances of success. If you manage to keep the allergen exposure low and control the symptoms well with medication, Chucker says, you can also treat allergic asthma with immunotherapy. Additionally, Chucker sees a great need in a different population, people who do not have an animal in the house, but suffer from allergens that pet owners carry into public spaces. These are the people we could do well to help with specific immunotherapy, he says. Say, one tablet a day for 3 years? That certainly seems manageable for those willing to take the risks. But there's no guarantee of success. Symptoms are likely to lessen but not disappear completely, and they may return after a few years. Whether that prospect is enough to try it is something every pet owner must decide for themselves. You've been listening to Science Digest with readings from Scientific American. This is Lynn Spears, volunteer reading with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening to this week's episode, and I hope you come back again next time. Have a great day.